Hey there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave, Maximizing Revenue Rupert, and with me is Chris, Clicks on the Homepage Boyer. Chris.
Hey, Dave. I guess if you sound maybe just slightly different today, Dave is, of course, on assignment out there. And
I'm maximum business right now. I'm wearing a rayon shirt, doing business.
Yeah, fantastic. We have a guest on the show today that I can't wait to introduce. We might as well just do it right now. Jerry McGovern. Hey, how you doing, Jerry?
Hello, Chris, and hello, Dave, and thanks a million for having me on the show.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk to you. This will be an easy conversation, I think, because there's just so many things that you talk about and talking about so passionately for a long, long time, and it's a shame we haven't had you on earlier than this. I think I met you because we end up at the same an event apart once in a while, right? You've probably...
Yeah.
They generally put Jerry at the very final thing because of how great his live speaking is, and, you know, he's kind of tells it like it is, speaks frankly about, and what is it about? I think if there's anything that it seems to me you talk about the most, it's this whole idea of customer experience, right?
Yeah, I think that's the, you know, the basic theme that's coming back to her, that, you know, you got to design with and for people today. It's, you know, because they're so challenging and so connected and so skeptical and they're not trusting in big brands and big organizations like they used to. So the customer has become a more challenging prospect if you don't really understand them well.
Yeah, you mentioned that a lot in talks. You know, like, I'm trying to think. I have some quotes from you that we can bring up from some stuff. So there's brands that kind of yell at you and scream at you from across the street. Hey, come over here. Everything's going to be awesome when you come over and join our brand and whatever it is we're trying to sell you. And then having those brands, then you arrive and you have their attention for this fleeting moment. You've done the hardest thing. And then so many brands just kind of continue screaming at you or aren't listening to you. Is that one of their kind of greatest failings?
Absolutely. I've had a saying for years that offline marketing is about getting attention, but online marketing is about giving attention. And a lot of organizations fail to recognize that when somebody is on the app or is on the website, that they're committed. They've committed in some way to do something. And oftentimes, the organization is killing that experience by, you know, big happy smiley faces or ridiculous videos or stuff that nobody's really interested in, but except the digital team and maybe the senior management in the process. So that's a core challenge of a kind of getting out of the way of the customer and letting them do what they really need to do, rather than constantly selling them these big concepts about, you're going to be so happy when you find out the specifications of this car, but you can't find out the actual specifications of the car, you know?
This is our most powerful car yet.
But we're not going to tell you why, or we're not going to explain it to you. You know, it's a mystery.
Yeah, one faster than the other car.
So is there a, you know, if you're, I'll probably have questions that end up tying it back to things I do or things I've had experience with. Is there, let's say you're some online piece of software. Is it almost like two different websites? Is one of them like the pre-logged in kind of sales website where you are making these grand promises and happy smiling faces? And then once they've logged in and done that first step of committing, then it's like all that stuff goes away and a new experience emerges in which you're doing more listening and trying to get out of the way, as you say.
Yeah, it's a kind of like that. But what I've found, Chris, over the years from observing people is that they're more and more jumping that first experience, and that, you know, particularly for more complicated products, we find people are more and more, they're on the support website and they're hanging around the community or they're looking, well, what's it actually like to configure? I think people believe less and less today of these, it's going to be amazing when you buy it type of stories. And either they're looking to use it to do a Slack and see, well, what's it actually like to use? And so I think a lot of the amazing messaging, it may work for Coca-Cola or something like that, but for an increasing other range of products, we either want to find somebody who has used it, you know, how does Airbnb or Slack or, you know, or else try it ourselves. So I think people are either with a lot more detailed questions than historically they did, and are a lot less open to the amazing promise of what it's going to be like when you give us the $200.
Yeah. I mean, you've just described me. I mean, I feel that heavily. Like especially if I'm buying some kind of technology focused thing in any way, whether it's, I don't even can think of examples, or hosting or something, like, well, fine, show me the admin panel then. Like, what does it actually like look like when I'm signed into this thing? What features does it have? Show me the documentation. I might not even read it, but I want to know that it's there. Exactly. So I can see.
Exactly.
It.
Well, yeah, well, Chris, you know, you're like thousands, tens of thousands, and a real trend out there, like that we've become so jaded by promises. And I think in society in general, like, there's a collapse in institutional trust, but that trust has not disappeared. It has kind of gone to the peer network. Social trust actually is where trust has gone today. You know, you either want to find somebody who's used it, and that's, you know, and somebody like you who's running a website who has similar type of experience, then you're going to really listen to that type of person. And if they give it 3 stars or 5 stars or whatever, and I know there's lots of scenarios trying to game that system, but still the finding people like you who have used the product is the most powerful. The current customer, who is most organizations totally neglect, they're the core of the newer kind of business models in the world. Like a couple of weeks ago, I was in Seville, and I was talking to a bunch of university marketers and communicators. And I said, is there one person in the room who actually spends more time on current customers than on your current students than on your potential students? And there wasn't a single person.
Wow.
Everything is relentlessly focused on the promise for the potential student. And yet, when you think about it from a university point of view, you've got current students who are savvy, social, etc. And they get terrible systems, and they get essentially broadly ignored once they join the university.
So it's like what you're saying is the university's quote-unquote problem is we need more students. So their solution is billboards and anything they can to reach new students, because that seems like a one-to-one. Like, oh, we need to reach people that aren't students yet and get them to be students. But you're saying if we focused on our actual students...
If you made them happier, got them jobs coming out of college.
They are your billboards then.
Exactly, because that's exactly, you know, the new billboard is the current customer. You know, the new marketing is, because what's happening now all over the world is these independent rating sites are coming up for universities of, you know, real students saying, what's it really like to be a student in Edinburgh or Manchester or Utah or San Francisco or whatever it's been. And people are more gravitating, you know, an 18-year-old or 17-year-old or 16-year-old, if they're reading the real stories of a 22-year-old or an 18-year-old who is just doing the first semester or finished. I mean, that's influential stuff.
And you might even be able to reach them more cost-effectively. It almost was like, God, I wish you could be more... probably should be very genuine with how you're talking to your existing customers, because you really do care about them and you really do care about their success. But even if you didn't and you just wanted to, that sounds horrible to say, but it's still a more cost-effective way to do it. You know, if you reach out to a single student and really make them happy in some way and they turn out and write some article about you or share it with all their Facebook friends or something, that was probably a lot cheaper than buying a Super Bowl ad or whatever.
Well, absolutely, Chris. But the core of it is, you got to stop talking to them and do stuff like make the scheduling easier. You know, if they've got a problem in their dorm that, you know, management is on it really quickly, you know, like if they're depressed or need some, you know, need a bit of support, or, you know, give them that support. You know, do all the things you promised them when they were potential students. Like, you know, live the promise. Be the promise. Be the communication. And I think it's the universities now that actually have a good social life, or have lots of sport, and actually treat their students really well, where there's good accommodation, you know, they can live reasonably well, you know, on a budget, or what budget should they live on, or how do you help them if they're on a tight budget? So I think it's like, you know, when we look at something like Slack or whatever, we think, well, it's actually easy. It doesn't promise that it's easy, and it treats you fairly. You know, so if you've got 20 people or 100 people and 20 of them stop using Slack, you know, they'll send you a refund for the 20. These are radical concepts of actually.
Yeah, I've gotten one of those before. Like, here's your $5.89 back because one person stopped posting messages in Slack. You're like, what?
But think how radical that is, Chris. Think of all the other SaaS models. They're profitability, if they want to get really serious profitability, a lot of that is based on selling you 300 licenses and you only use 200.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of, and then you go back to me, oh yeah, but you signed up for a year, you know, so I can't change. You know, it's like, we got you. Like, it's like, you know, we found a clever way to get more money out of you for less service. Whereas, you know, the really good brands, I mean, whether we like Amazon or not, they actually generally treat you fairly as a customer.
Yeah, that's another thing that you say, right, is that these big companies like Amazon, and there's other examples you use as well, even big stuff like Apple, is that part of what they're building of those businesses was they really do care about you as a customer and come through on that.
Yeah, and you know, whether maybe some of us might think Apple has lost its way a bit, some not, but like Apple came up from customer experience. I mean, they were the original masters of, I mean, they designed a PC that didn't need a manual, you know, yeah. Like, mm-hmm. You know, they designed something that you could actually use intuitively, you know, so their whole concepts in the early days was actually create a great experience for people that doesn't need to be explained or whatever. And I think today is that sort of movement. We got to truly deliver today, not promise things, mm-hmm. but just deliver. Stop promising stuff. Like, you never come to Google and Google says, we promise we'll help you find really great search results. You know, it's like, are you having a good time searching on Google? You know, like, you know, you never get that sort of stuff. And people say, yeah, but that's just Google. That's just search. But search is everything today. You know, like, everything we do begins with a search. Practically 99 experiences out of 100 begin with a Google search. So, you know, they are the portal now to everything, because they help us find stuff, and that's so important to us as people, to, you know, find stuff quickly. And the other organization, they miss the whole point of why Google. I showed a really big brand recently. I said, you know, they're trying to get more serious into e-commerce, and you know, they're maybe a bit traditional in their focus. And I said, well, let's look at Amazon. They say, oh, no, I don't want to look at Amazon's ugly, and Amazon's horrible. I says, yeah, Amazon is only the most powerful retailer on earth. You know, they wanted to look at Nike, and, you know, they want to, you know, because they had all these cool designers and, you know, who really, you know, they say, oh, no, Amazon, I would never do it the Amazon way. What sort of mentality is that? Like, you know, that, you know, these are the entity, this is who's, you know, because at core Amazon is get you cheap prices, get you fast delivery, you know, the essential concepts that drive the Amazon model are the essence of don't talk about it, do it.
Right. Deliver, quite literally, in two ways.
And they're relentless. Like, can we get it to you in an hour? Can we get it to you? Because that's, they know the faster they can deliver for us, the more business we'll do with them.
Yeah, and it turns into two ways. You know, if I meet somebody and they're like, "Ah, oh, I never order things online," you know, like it almost turns the conversation immediately to me being like, "Really? You don't? That's great. We have Amazon Prime. It's amazing. You got to try it. The stuff's on your doorstep in 2 seconds." You know, like that's come out of my mouth before. You know, I've turned into a not just somebody that's like, "Oh, you should try this," but to a fierce advocate, because I'm like, "Oh my God, it changed my life. I've been doing this for it feels like a decade now. You got to get on board."
Yeah, yeah. And what? And was that because of some Saatchi and Saatchi advertising or? You know, it was because you tried it and it worked.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Log Rocket, which is like for creating the perfect front-end bug report. It's like every error that happens is shown in the context of the user that experienced that error with a full video replay. It's like you reproduce an issue and can see it happen as if it happened in your own browser. You do look at it in your own browser. So you like watch a video replay. It helps you understand what the user did to trigger that bug. So it's like zero mystery involved when a bug happens. And which is kind of not always perfectly evident in original bug report. So it basically they instrument the DOM to record the HTML and CSS on the page, recreating the pixel perfect video of like what happened in it. But in addition, they record like console logs, JavaScript errors, the stack trace, all the network requests and responses that happen with a header in the body and all that, browser metadata, all the stuff. So there's everything you need to figure out not only an error happened, what did it look like? Like, can, you know, because sometimes an error gets triggered and that sucks and you should fix that. But like, now you'll know for sure, did it actually impact that user and their user experience of using your site or not? Did it just kind of like happen, some kind of error happened, but it didn't really like stop the user from being what they were able to do? So that's just a big deal. It's just pretty cool. So that's what Log Rocket does, the perfect front-end bug report. So it's logrocket.com/shoptalk to check it out. Compare it to other tools out there if you'd like to. There's lots to learn about it. Pretty powerful, pretty cool. You can get started for free. Thanks, Log Rocket.
I have a question. Like, how do you build this trust? I guess deliver is maybe your answer, but I've been a part of, you know, companies before and they're like, you know, let's give somebody a $20 gift card for creating an account, or, you know, they're just trying to like drum up business, you know. I guess what do you think, just if we focus on the current customer experience, that tends to trickle out, or what are other ways we can like build customer trust?
Well, I think it's the core. I think in a sense, you know, trust is, as you said, Dave, it's delivery, and it's delivery again and again and again. And it's, you know, often the most critical moment that trust really comes fashioned either strongly or weakly is when somebody has a problem, you know. And, you know, here's the irony of if everyone's obsessing about customer experience. And yet, if you look at the organizational hierarchical cycle, the people who are most dealing with customers are at the absolute bottom of the organizational hierarchy. They get the least paid, they get the least respect, and in all likelihood, if possible, they get outsourced, you know, to another country. And and often the further you go up the organizational structure, the more you meet people who have practically no interaction with their customers or understand their customers. So it's a kind of a radical new rethinking of, you know, what's that crowd that that Amazon bought that used to sell the shoes, Zappos? You know, they used to have a tagline. I don't know if they still have it. They said, "We're a customer service company that happens to sell shoes." You know, and it's a kind of like really getting that culture of customer service that, you know, we really want to build around. We want to make it easier. We're relentlessly focused on delivery and making it smoother and making it easier. And really, you know, designing with the customer, right? So many organizations, I find this, say, no, they got to go this journey. They got to do that. And they got to they gotta use the configurator. They got to use, you know, we set these things that we want them to do because we feel that if we force them through these steps, somebody told us at some stage that's going to maximize the conversion rate. So we keep coming at it from how we're going to design an environment that the customers are going to fit into. Whereas I think the newer models are really designing with customers. Are kind of, there's so much more feedback, so much more, you know, I saw a great presentation there recently, but you know, with Google Maps, where Sarah Watcher, she has a double barreled name. Occasionally, she showed there was this thing that so you put in your walking, you're going from two distances in Google Maps, and it's a 20-minute walk, and it says something like, that's going to save you 80 calories, and that's equivalent of one mini cupcake. So you can see it was a nice idea, but then because Google is so set up for feedback, within an hour they had loads of feedback. Oh, this is shamey, you know, all calories are not equal, you know, pink cupcakes are not neutral, they're feminine, etc. So they got all this negative feedback for the feature within about 60 minutes. Within 3 hours, they had taken it off. You know, it took a lot longer than 3 hours to develop that feature. But within 3 hours, they'd removed it because, hey, they knew that they were getting such a volume of feedback. But in most organizations I deal with, the cupcake has molded into fungi. It's there 6 years. You know, it's absolutely toxic and destroying customer credibility. And the organization actually knows, but is incapable of removing it because they don't have any capacity really to respond in any sort of agile way. I mean, what is agility if you can't respond to customers? Is, you know, agility is not about, you know, running 100-meter sprints in the organization in the wrong direction. Like it's actually being able to respond to customer behavior and whether they like, dislike, tweaking, etc. And most organizations can't do that because their current customers are so alien to them.
It was nice that that story wasn't about, you know, maybe they should have tested that feature on users first. Maybe that's true, but it's almost even cooler that, bummer, it did ship, but they got feedback and they respond to it really quickly. So there, it was their response time to real user feedback that is good. And it doesn't necessarily like shame them into being like, you should have found that before it even went out. Sometimes stories are like that, you know, when some privacy related feature comes out, that's like, that should have never come anywhere near production. That's a slightly different story, but even when it does.
I think there's a very important point there, Chris, that a lot of organizations are so fearful of being wrong and so fearful of making, they're always chasing the perfect state that they always live in the past because the time they've launched it, it's 2 or 3 years, you know, and you never get to the perfect state anyway. I think the only way, you always are in beta, like that there is no, like the whole world has changed. I mean, if we go back 20 years ago, we had to do this and then we had to send it into a CD-ROM and then we had to post it to blah, blah, blah. So it was the type of thing 20 years ago that if you got stuff wrong and there was a bug in those 100,000 CD-ROMs, you know, that was a major problem for the company. But today,
right.
we can have much greater, instead of, you know, and that CD-ROM contained a 3 month or a 6 month, you know, development cycle. But today we can have a 2 day, or we can just, you know, like Google will constantly be dropping things into their Google Maps or whatever, and just seeing, you know, is it actually working or not? And if it's working, they'll design with the customer and evolve it. And if it's not working, they'll take it off. I mean, how do you know it's not working? These are important questions. I mean, do you immediately respond if blah, blah, blah? You know, so understanding how do you actually know something is not working or not? Or maybe if we give them another couple of weeks, they would get used to it. But these are new skill sets. I think we need to, you know, get much more nimble, much more agile, and see the customer as a designer, particularly the current customer, that they can be the most important designer in the room.
Yeah, it is a new skill set because you even, I think you might, even just, I think in your most recent blog post said that sometimes an indicator of success, like for example, how many times it gets clicked on, might not always automatically mean that that thing is wildly successful.
No, there was like that with this crowd who create the citizen advice, the best will in the world to create this section called quick links. But sure, you know, everyone wants a quick link. You know, quick links is like free beer. You know, it's like...
We'll just put these on the page and it works and everyone's going to click it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and they're going to have the expectation because nobody wants to click on a slow link, you know, so like, so therefore what they discovered was quick links was really popular because everybody was expecting to find everything behind their quick link. Whereas they only had 4 or 5 types of tasks behind the quick link. And essentially, it had become popular because it had made this massive promise that it couldn't deliver on. So it was a kind of, it was creating tremendous traffic, but it was traffic that was creating frustration and annoyance from its customers. So just because if you've got a very badly architected application or website, it could well be that the parts of your website that seem to be popular because of Google Trends, they're not popular because they're useful. They're popular because they got into some sort of a circular linking, or you know, that they reinforce themselves. Sometimes you get this reinforcement. A link just needs to rise above all the other links a little bit, and then Google sees it and everybody starts reinforcing it. But it's not because it was the right way. So sometimes the wrong way can get reinforced, and then it gets embedded into the structure and gets very difficult to remove or do anything about.
So is that metric of like how many times is something hovered and clicked, or like let's say just clicked, it just clicks is maybe not the kind of data that you should be.
Well, it's not that it's wrong, Chris, in the sense, mm-hmm. what it could be wrong. And what it is that we need multiple sources of insight. If we're depending on just a single source of customer insight, that's quite dangerous. So we need, you know, like if you're in Netflix, yeah, they'll do that data analytics, but they'll also do lots of A/B testing. They'll also do other sort of testing. They'll do focus groups. They'll do multiple source because each source has a kind of a weakness. And when you bring 3 or 4 different sources of customer insight together, one tends to balance the other. Like the way citizens' advice discovered the problem was they started giving tasks to, you know, people coming to the website saying, oh, you just lost your, you know, this is a website more for people who have, you know, they've lost their mortgage or their credit cards have gone mad or stuff like that. So the giving tasks like that. And of course, they were all clicking on quick links, you know, so they could then begin to say, oh, well, but I think what's crucial is we need at least 2 to 3 sources of customer insight, because all sources have some weaknesses to them. You know, data on its own is really telling you about what activity is happening, but it's not really telling you why it's happening.
Yes. See, that's so good.
Yeah, you almost need somebody to like read the tea leaves sort of, you know, you have these clicks, you have these times on the page, you have this everything, but you don't really know what it means until somebody can diffuse a picture.
Exactly. And a lot of times, Dave, that's in the context of, you know, something that they're doing. I remember with Microsoft years ago, that in Excel, they had this page. There were lots of people were searching for remove conditional formatting. And they said, oh, let's create a page for that because there's a lot of search volume for it. So they created a page, but they never could get good satisfaction. And what they ultimately discovered was that people would be in Excel, and they had to do a bit of research to try and understand this, and they'd be doing conditional formatting, and they'd make a mess of it. And their trigger behavior would be to search to remove it. But what they really wanted to do was to format properly in conditional formatting. So the page told them about how to remove the conditional formatting, but then it didn't, it had no links, or it didn't tell them how to do formatting properly. You know, so they ended up, they deleted the page for remove conditional formatting. And they made sure when somebody searched for remove conditional formatting, they found this overall page showing you how to format, how to remove, how to do conditional formatting. Satisfaction, satisfaction rose really quickly. So you need that, you know, if you're only looking at the where, who clicked on, what got clicked on, sometimes you can actually reinforce negative behaviors, or so you need a couple of insight sources.
How, like, do you have any recommendations for sources like that? I know you have your kind of top task, kind of curriculum, but like CSAT is like a one I hear in enterprise-y stuff. Is that something you'd recommend, or like?
You know, it's not the Jared Spool absolutely hates it and stuff like that. You know, it has weaknesses because it's a kind of a what's called a lagging indicator, or it's very difficult for people in our area in the digital realm to actually affect CSAT because it tends to be a much bigger type of, you know, metric. You know, you could be overpricing and your CSAT will go down. You know, the CSAT, it's not bad, but it's got a lot. It's a very what you call laggy. You know, often the score will not really reflect the current state. It will be because of either something that happened 3 or 4 weeks ago, or it's not fabulous, but it's useful. You know, it's one other source, but I you know, I know I sound like a broken record, but the best thing I've ever found in this is to give people a task, you know, give people a clearly articulated task, something that this thing should do, you know, and you know that there's a lot of demand to do that, you know, transfer money between your accounts or configure this, blah, blah, blah. And just watch. You don't need to watch a lot of them. And it's amazing. You know, when you do that with 5 or 10 people, how the patterns really begin to jump out about what's actually happening in this environment in the process.
So I guess, like, if let's say order a T-shirt or order a dress would be my like top task. How, I guess, do I guess I submit users to that through some kind of user testing, and then what am I looking for?
You're looking for patterns. So what you want to do is you want to, creating the task seems easy. You can just, but it's so important. So you want to create a very specific task. You want a T-shirt with this sort of customization in black cotton, size medium.
A kind of a medium to complicated task, like not just order any shirt you
no,
want.
No, but yeah, because nobody's going to order any shirt. Nobody ever comes to a website saying, I'm going to order a T-shirt, any T-shirt. I don't care what's on it or what size it is. You know,
I just should reflect reality a little bit.
Yeah, I just want to order a T-shirt. You know, I want to watch a video. I don't care what sort of. You know, show me any video. I haven't seen a video in days. You know, okay. like you gotta, because everyone will come with their size or their look. So you gotta give a real, not a complicated one. Start with the most basic. If it was T-shirts, you'd start with the most popular. Soul teach to see is the core paths working, and then essentially, whether you do user testing unmoderated or moderate, you're looking for the patterns. You're looking you know, that's the fourth person that stumbled there, you know, in the process. Why did they click on that button? They, you know, we expected they'd click on this. You're looking for the patterns because the patterns are always there. There's the, every environment I've ever done this in, there's human behaviors. If somebody is sick, you know, how they'll react to symptoms, how they'll react to prognosis. You know, people in Norway broadly, and we've done this sort of testing, broadly will approach dealing with symptomatic issue in the same way as Irish people, in the same way as British people. You know, there's certain core ways humans behave. The way they search, the way they click, you know, that how people will, you know. So what you'll see as a classic pattern is oftentimes people will go to navigation. Mm-hmm. So they'll go navigating mm-hmm. around a bit and then they might revert to search. So if you can identify that there's common type of points where they jump from the navigation to the search box, you know that there's something there in the navigation that's really sending them to a dead end. Like they've tried clicking on two or three links. And then if you say, that's the fourth person that's gone to search from that page, why the hell is that? You know, like and we become like detectives in why is that constantly happening that they jump to search from that? And then what you should do is look at what they're searching for, because in all likelihood, what they're searching for is something close to approximating to what they wanted to find as a link to click on in that page.
Right.
You know, there's some sort of a gap that has occurred. Now, I'm not saying that all that sort of jump from navigation itself, but that's a very common pattern that I'd see. People that start navigating and then they jump to search. So where they stop the navigational journey can be very interesting. And see, this is the type of stuff that we need to be watching quite a bit before it really begins to clarify. Like the first time you do this sort of stuff, it won't be as clear, but as you do it more and more, you'll say, that's not just the first test we've seen this happening, you know, that's happening loads and loads of times. You know, you'll see these universalist patterns that begin to emerge. And I think that's what we, you know, I remember talking to somebody once in Facebook, and he says, we don't design the journeys, we design for the journeys. Like Facebook, the product managers are trained to constantly ask, why is this happening? Why is this happening? Why is this happening? And then they scale already existing journeys rather than try and come up with brand new ways of doing stuff and then hope that people will kind of accept those. Like, you know, in fashion, you know, a lot of the great fashion designers, they didn't come up with the fashion. They hang around alleys in New York or in San Francisco and they see, you know, what are the kids picking up on? You know, that it's already a kind of happening and they know, hey, it's that color is really beginning to hit in the New York subculture. And then 12 months later, they have it out in Milan or whatever. But it wasn't so much that they a kind of in an amazing yoga moment on the top of a mountain decided, oh, it's going to be yellow. They already saw yellow was taking off in the New York hip hop community. You know, and I think we get these opportunities in the data and in the observation of customers, because we've never had an opportunity to observe human behavior like we have on the web. Now, we can do it for good and ill, but I mean, shouldn't we be embracing that ability to truly understand the patterns of human behavior that are out there on the web?
This is great. I mean, I think I spend way too much. I get really focused on the code or the design or the, you know, like just kind of dreaming up the feature and kind of like that observation of what the user is doing. I think I miss that a lot.
Isn't this is kind of a classic Jerry quote, right? Or as classic as far as I'm concerned, that always gets a laugh if you ask me, as Jerry says, the worst way to design digital is five smart people in a room drinking lattes. The longer you leave them, the worse the result will become. That's you, and that's hilarious.
Well, that's kind of what Dave, but we all do that. I've been through, yeah. You know, the desire, you know, I'm more a writer, so I like to write. I don't want to, you know, and we want to, you would code and want to, the urge, but to step back a little bit and design wit. and I kind of get it out there and design true use. Find a model where we're, you know, you're getting that essence of the feature, Dave, but then you're getting it into use and you say, interesting. You know, I see, you know, and it'll be so much better. And actually, we get a better experience much faster. And it's very satisfying as well as you see that feedback coming back. And I think the really clever organizations are really developing a Tura feedback mechanism by which they learn true use.
I guess how... I think like a lot, most organizations I've been a part of, they're like, the one metric that matters is that the money metric goes up, you know? And, but I definitely like this, a different approach, I guess, like you kind of need that agile process in place where you can ship quickly and then fix quickly and iterate. And, but I like this kind of, I don't know, a dance with the user where you're kind of like, okay, you're going this way. All right, let me see if I can kind of accommodate that or let's kind of work together to get you, you know, to buy this t-shirt.
Well, exactly, you know? Because they're there. They're not there, you know, wanting to buy golf clubs. They're not there. They're actually there wanting to buy a t-shirt. I mean, chances are, if somebody comes to that t-shirt company website, they actually want to buy a t-shirt or they want to get a price for a t-shirt. So you're not converting them. You're supporting them in their process. And you know, so the companies that really are making the money are the ones that are designing the services that most fit the customer need.
No, that's powerful.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by Jetpack, literally jetpack.com. If you're running a self-hosted WordPress site, as I run a whole bunch of and, you know, a massive swath of the internet does, I think Jetpack is one of these like no-brainer plugins. There's no performance negative for running Jetpack. In fact, it's completely the opposite. There's all kinds of performance enhancing things that it can do. For example, with the flip of a switch, you can get all of your images hosted on your site in your content hosted from WordPress CDN. You know, one of the like common things that you should do to speed up your site is serve assets from a CDN, an image CDN. Boom, you have Jetpack, you flip it on, now you're serving images from a CDN, and WordPress itself has responsive images, so you're serving responsive images from a CDN. That's just one of tons of features in Jetpack that are incredibly useful and performance enhancing. Flip another switch, you're lazy loading those images. So if there's one three big scrolls down, it's not even loading that image at all unless it's needed. That's a huge performance benefit. So that's just some perf stuff, but there's other features like flip another switch and now you can write in Markdown, like the WordPress default good Markdown that's going to be supported, and offer Markdown to people commenting on your site as well. Another big one that I use is I hook it up to Facebook and Twitter. So on my blog, when I publish a post, it can automatically goes to those places. I don't need to like sit there and handcraft a tweet and hand attach my featured image. It's all just a nicely crafted social media message that automatically goes to those places, and it can put sharing links for social networks into my post in my theme as well. That's just, what did we mention? Three features of the like dozens in Jetpack. It's such a nice plugin. Thanks for the sponsorship. We'll tell you about more features later, but you should, you know, go check it out. If you're running a WordPress site, just install it and see what it can do for you. Sometimes I can't help myself here, and I have to pull it into something related to what I'm doing. So I spent some time recently on CodePen, and I have this little mini feature that I think would be cool. We try to stop ourselves from doing that because it's a little bit like you can't run a whole company just on person after person at the company, just gut instinct creating a feature and pushing it to production, because you'll have this Frankenstein beast of a product that maybe doesn't match any particular vision. But anyway, I think there's enough evidence that we've collected over the years of running it that people have a little bit of a hard time of getting back to some of their own work. So you use CodePen to create stuff. And over the time that you're using it as a customer,
you sometimes can create a big empire of work. And we've tried a number of ways to make sure that it's easy to find that stuff. So this would be like a task, right? Like get back to something that you've created on CodePen that's important to you, that you're looking for or trying to find. So the new feature is, and I have no idea if this is going to see the light of day or not, but maybe this conversation will help guide this, is this idea of pinning up something that you're working on, and it could be any number of different things on CodePen. So you just, it's an icon, you click it, and now it's pinned, kind of like a favorite or something, another. Yep. So it's just temporarily there, but there's also a menu attached to it. So it's kind of a double function button. You can pin it, or you can drop a little drop down that'll show you things that you've pinned. And so there's a whole list of them in there, and they're really easy to add and remove. To add it, you click the pin. To remove it, you click the little X next to the thing in the menu. And the whole idea is just, it's this ever-evolving, how I envision it, is that it's this ever-evolving little menu of things that I've decided are important to me. Now, I've scoped it out, but I haven't really, really talked to any users about it. I haven't done much in that regard. I just think it would be a good feature. Now, what should I do right now? Should I push it and then talk to customers about it and get their feedback on it? Or should I wait and schedule some one-on-one type of stuff to talk with people about it before it sees the light of day? Or
I suppose some degree, and the challenges are how easy to push it and take it back. It is, but let's say you made it live. Yeah. One of the things would be not to talk to people, about it, but to actually, try and construct some tasks that need to use it, and give people, those tasks. Four or five people who use, and just see, are they actually finding it? Can, at its most basic level, is it becoming clear in the structure that, oh, so you want to bookmark or something, for later, so to go back, here's this, bookmark this, set up a test account or something, and just see, can people actually do it to begin with? And then, then you might see, as you get into that use, that people will start, they'll do the task, but then maybe some stuff will become obvious of some little fix you could make or something like that could make it better. But watching it being used is so powerful. Like, because imagine so much other stuff. If I create a hammer, and I don't see anyone using the hammer, so much, and I don't see anyone, I've created a car, but I don't see anyone getting into the car. It's not exactly analogous, but in so much we create all this stuff, and a lot of it isn't being used, and we should get rid of it, And the stuff that is being used, we should really expand it, if at all possible. But we need to get more evidence of how our environment is actually being used.
Yeah, it's that watch. I really like the idea of giving somebody a task where you don't tell them that this feature is there for them. In our case, it might be a little weird because they might have an existing workflow in which they've worked around this idea. And maybe just miss it. But if they miss it, that's telling, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I've had loads of situations where, there was a really helpful feature on a page that people just missed, because of its positioning. And it would have really helped them if they were looking for it, so to speak, but they couldn't find it. On the actual.
So page. Then, is it like? Is there? Do you, can you teach? Is there something to be said for it? If you teach somebody once, then they kind of remember it, or would you just be like, I don't know, it shouldn't require any teaching. This particular feature should.
In this day and age, Chris, if you have to teach, nobody reads the dev. You ever go to a website and it says, "Oh, we've made some changes. Please look through the little demo we have."
Skip.
If we don't discover a true use, it's discoverability, is sure. very, very, very poor. But also, I think, Chris, what you want to be doing is looking at CodePen, the core activities, and asking, are the core activities getting harder as the years go by? Like, are the top mm-hmm. tasks, you know, is the stuff that we really designed it for from day one, is that as easy as it was on day one?
Hey, that's a good way to look at it. Or have we got
like a product gets older? Is it stay the same like usefulness? I guess.
Well, of the essential stuff, you know, that the reason the product really resonated, you know, that sometimes the core original the core essence of the thing gets more complicated because we're constantly adding more features, etc. Now, we have to keep adding. We have to keep. But sometimes we reach a point where we've added so much complexity that actually the tool is less productive than it was 18 months ago. If somebody was to calculate, you know, getting the job done that they need to get done, and I'm sure you've experienced it yourselves, sometimes some products seem to go backwards in their actual core usefulness because they've added so much extraneous complexity that either it's slower to download, you know, or there's so many things to choose from that actually the ability to just do really important stuff quickly is not as easy as it was, you know, 6 or 12 months ago.
Yeah. Can you imagine if you were in Photoshop and had to design in that feature set and you had to be like, well, we have to push new stuff so people keep caring about the product, but it has 20 years of features in it and we can't just pull them all out because that's a problem too. Oh my God, there it's probably a great example of how difficult this can be.
Well, I was going to add, Chris mentioned like I have a gut feeling that this is a useful feature. Jerry, do you feel like you can ever build a gut like for what the customer wants and what the customer needs or is it does the customer always surprise?
No, they don't. And you know, if you can build it, but it takes time and it takes, you know, I was over in Oslo a couple of weeks ago and this one was telling me about this, you know, really successful. They're dealing with this entity. There's lots and lots of stores, and so he says, yeah, the stories you're telling me reminds me of this one of the most successful managers in this company. And I remember when he started, and somebody in management says, here's a desk, here's your desk, and here's your office. And he says, I don't want a desk, and I don't want an office. Buy me a better car. He says, you know, because I'm not going to be in the office. I'm not going to be, you know, he was a store manager and he ended up managing. And he was just always out there, you know, and getting at least. And the thing is, as well, some of the stuff we do, our friends are our customers. So it's not as if we're alien to our customers, so to speak. You know, we know we meet them at conferences, etc. So even though we don't think we know our customers, we actually do, you know, in a lot of the stuff that you do, Chris, or they, you know, you kind of know the world. But then if it's in a slightly different world, we need to build up that gut instinct. We need to, yeah, the patterns are repetitive. People, you know, 20 years ago for going on holidays, people wanted special offers. They still want them today. You know, getting here and around, things to do and see. You know, what's the three most important places I should visit in Dublin if I've only got 24 hours or whatever? You know, that's the same question in 100 cities. You know, so there are these core, like I'm doing a big project for health now, and there's this pattern in treatment that's a universal pattern. And it's, you know, what to do before the treatment. You know, so how do I need to prepare for going into hospital? Or so what happens during the treatment? So what's going to happen when I'm in the hospital? And then after the treatment, the recuperation period. So you can take every treatment, whether it's for cancer or whatever, and there's an essence, a before, during, and after. pattern in that, and that's going to repeat across all sorts of conditions that you're going to deal with.
Kind of like the customer journey, sort of. I think that's kind of called.
Yes, it is, Dave. But it's actually it's the customer journey that already exists. It's not that it's not that a bunch of Chris smart guys came up with the customer journey. It's that those journeys are already in existence. Those patterns are already there.
So how do you aid those travelers on that path?
Exactly. It's so much easier to aid them on the path there and to make it easier and faster and simpler on the journey that they already intuitively have in their brain. Because in a way, we need to get out of our gut instinct and into their gut instinct.
How scary is it if you just don't know? What, Yerk?
Well, it's random, Chris. It's a kind of, you could be lucky, you could be not lucky in the pro. And today, you know, the difference is, all, you know, everything is becoming so competitive that if you're a little bit off the mark, like the way we're so brutal when we come to a service now, if it doesn't really chime with us really quickly, if it doesn't feel like we're getting places with the drawing program or whatever we're using, if it doesn't feel like, you know, how long are we giving it? A minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes?
30 seconds, 25. It's going lower.
So if you totally resonate and in your brain it's before, during and after, and bang, you come to the page and it says before, during and after, you're going to say, you're not even going to say anything. You're just going to click, you know, because, wow, that's, and you won't even realize that, you know, that this thing has sucked you in because it's just mapped to your intuitive brain, you know, but it's not that you're the only one. There are dominant patterns out there that I found deal with up to 80% of the population in how we buy a car, how we choose a university, how we don't all think differently. We there's unusual edges, little bits to us, but broadly speaking, we go about buying a car the same way most people do.
Wow. Well, this has been amazing. I unfortunately do have a hard stop, so we'll have to have Jerry back because I'm curious how you feel about those chat widgets on websites. But we gotta stop.
So, Jerry, you have a newsletter since 1996. Over 2 decades of newsletter, customer experience insights. There's some classes you teach, a master class called Measuring the Digital Customer Experience with Top Tasks. Is there anything else you want to let people know about?
And if they go to jerrymcgovern.com, they'll find the latest stuff that's happening, and they'll find an ability to subscribe to the newsletter and upcoming courses and services. And we help. Yeah, I've got a partnership that if an organization is really trying to understand its customer, the Top Tasks approach is a methodology that can help them understand what truly matters to the customer.
Yeah, I'm completely sold on this Top Tasks methodology. So thank you, Jerry, for coming here. And if you guys, anyone out there gets a chance to see Jerry at a conference, bring popcorn. It's quite a show. So thank you, Jerry, for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one, because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.